Bangladesh, one day after the prime minister was pushed out of power, a new interim appointee is tipped to take over.
Professor Mohammad Yunus, who's a global icon, is going to head this interim government.
The remarkable political transition in Bangladesh. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Europe reacts to a U.S. antitrust ruling against Google. Its parent company has previously faced billions of dollars in penalties overseas.
Authorities in Europe have been concerned about Google and the other tech companies for quite a long time now.
And if you've ever hung out at your local climbing gym, then the competitors in Olympic sport climbing might look familiar.
They're incredibly talented at coordination, at power, at all the things that make a climber really amazing.
Yeah, but we've really got nothing on these Olympic athletes.
That's today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Bangladesh, Nobel laureate Mohammad Yunus will lead the country's interim government. It's the latest dramatic development after student-led protests toppled the government of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina just yesterday. The announcement came from Bangladesh's presidential office. Protest leaders were calling for Yunus to step in as interim leader. He is expected to return to Bangladesh from Paris soon, according to local news reports.
Bangladesh has a powerful military that historically has had a lot of say over government affairs, but the student movement has proved itself a seemingly equal force to be reckoned with. Shafkat Munir is with the Bangladesh Institute of Peace and Security Studies in the capital, Dhaka.
At this point or at this juncture, after we've had a people's revolution, we need an individual who has pan-national as well as global acceptability and significance. And that person right now, according to the eyes of most Bangladeshis, is Professor Mohammad Yunus, who, as the symbol, as a uniting symbol for this nation, would be able to realize the aspirations of the people in this revolution. Because what the people are asking for is a restructure, a reform, and an overhauling of the Bangladeshi state so that we never again slip back into an autocratic regime again.
Will Mohammad Yunus have to have the army supporting him?
Yes, of course. Mohammad Yunus will have to have the army, the whole nation behind him. But yes, in order to stabilize, in order to bring back order, the army would be a very important backstop and their support would be absolutely essential.
So let's talk about the military. How would you describe the behavior of Bangladesh's military to events over the last 48 hours?
I think the military has played an overall a very positive role. They have been trying to stabilize the situation. They have been trying to restore order. It's trying to be a positive catalyst. They're trying to work with the people. They're trying to stand with the people. They're trying to work with the political parties.
Shafkat, I'm wondering how different the military's posture is right now than it has been in the past.
The Bangladeshi military has won many accolades for the country through international peacekeeping and other international humanitarian operations and so on. And it has always tried to stand by the people. Whenever political upheaval has taken place, it has tried to stand by the people. And as we saw, the Bangladeshi military once again is trying to listen to the people's aspirations and help the country get into the right path through the formation of a new interim government.
After being in power for so long, what was it that finally persuaded Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign and flee the country?
I think Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina had not realized how angry the people were, how unpopular she had become, and how vitiated the atmosphere had become over the last month or so with the protests and the wanton use of brutal force against the protesters. So it had reached a point where it was just untenable for her to continue in power. But I think what finally led to the coup de grace is probably the realization that it would be impossible to control the crowd which was converging near her residence. And the public anger against the regime had just become so overwhelming. And there was absolutely no way, even with brutal force, that could be contained.
Shafkat, do we know yet whether the Bangladeshi military simply refused to carry out Sheikh Hasina's orders to crack down on protesters?
We still don't have details, but I think the military made it very clear that they will not fire on the protesters at all.
For you as a Bangladeshi, what makes this political moment in your country so meaningful?
I am deeply optimistic. I am deeply energized. I'm deeply hopeful about what lies ahead. This monsoon revolution is a people's revolution. It is not a revolution brought out by political actors or this group or that group. It's a pan-national people's revolution where students, workers, different professional groups, housewives, children, everybody came out. And it is an agenda which this country is trying to create for change, for economic growth, for prosperity, for development, and to create an equitable and just social order and a country which will basically be able to give the power, the voice back to the people, and a country which in the international scene will also adhere to the rules-based international system.
I mean, yesterday's images of Bangladeshis gathering at parliament, climbing on and bringing down statues, hanging out in Sheikh Hasina's living quarters after she fled. Where does that euphoria stand today?
People are still euphoric, but at the same time, I think the authorities are concerned that we can't have arson, we can't have mob rule or disorderly activities, while at the same time recognizing the public euphoria stemming from the revolution.
I mean, first steps, what will be the most urgent issues that the interim government in Bangladesh are going to have to deal with?
The most urgent issue would be to restore law and order. The most urgent issue would be to make sure economic activity is back on full swing, and also to give our neighbors and the whole world confidence that Bangladesh is back on track and it has a properly charted reform agenda to create a new Bangladesh where power belongs to the people, people's voting rights are not snatched away as it was in the past, and where we have a just, equitable society, and where Bangladesh takes its rightful place in the international system.
We have seen a number of revolutions in recent years around the globe. Egypt, for example, the Arab Spring, things have not turned out so well there. How do you prevent a backslide?
That's probably our biggest challenge, because I'm completely in agreement with you. And we are all cognizant of the fact that there have been many revolutions where ultimately it became a false dawn. And we hope that our new dawn will be an effective agenda for change, as long as we can remain united as a country, as long as we have great leadership, and as long as we are absolutely clear-eyed about our North Star, which is a need for reform, a need for restructure, and need for overhaul.
Do you think protesters are prepared to give the interim government a decent chance to prove itself?
I think the protesters are willing to give the interim government a decent chance to prove themselves, yes.
Shafkat Munir is a research fellow at the Bangladesh Institute of Peace and Security Studies, a think tank in the capital, Dhaka.
An Israeli airstrike killed at least 30 people who were sheltering at a school in Gaza yesterday. Most of the dead were women and children, according to a Palestinian official. This is the third time in the past week that Israeli strikes have hit locations where people were taking shelter. The Israeli military says it is targeting Hamas command and control centers. Civilians in Gaza are facing another threat in addition to airstrikes. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, diseases are also on the rise.
Manar al-Hassi first noticed a red pimple on her daughter's head. At first, she didn't think much of it. The next day, it began to spread over her body. Soon, her face was filled with pimples, she says, the buzz of Israeli drones in the background. It was terrifying, she tells the Associated Press. In recent weeks, there has been a rise in skin diseases in Gaza. The World Health Organization says 150,000 people suffer from scabies, lice, and other skin ailments. All of those in the tents are the same, says Adel Abu Obeid. All of the children have some sort of skin rash, he says, holding up his toddler son, who has rashes and blisters on his belly. Summer temperatures can rise up to more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit in Gaza. Clean water is scarce. Shower and toilets are luxuries. So are soaps and shampoo. Personal hygiene is key to preventing some of these diseases, says Amy Lowe with the medical organization Doctors Without Borders.
Some of my staff told me that when they go in the market and try to find shampoo, they find a bottle that costs $30, and when they open it, it's diluted and it's not really shampoo. Someone said they found a bottle of Pantene shampoo and it was $40. And that's if they can find it. And those prices is, we can't afford that.
Lowe has been working at the pediatric and maternity wards at Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza for the past month. She says it's one of the few remaining hospitals that are functioning. They've had to ration out the amount of soap and disinfectant that they give out to each department.
You know, we rationalize which is the most critical department, and they get, you know, one bottle and the other ones get half a bottle, or we have to do the math for this.
Outside the hospital, trash has piled up, wastewater is not being treated, and people are living in a constant state of uncertainty. After almost a year of war and most of the water and sewage system destroyed, many rely on water that's been trucked in. Mohammed Hanouna is one of them. He was standing in line with others recently, jerry can in hand. He told the AP that he has to walk about a mile every day for water. There's no life here, he says. We're not really living. Even the donkeys in Gaza have a better life.
This is completely preventable. There is no need for 2 million people of Gaza to be in a such situation.
Tarek Yasharovich is the spokesperson for the World Health Organization. He says out of 36 hospitals, only 16 are partly functioning, and that diseases that once had been considered eradicated, like polio, are coming back.
At the end of the day, what we need is a ceasefire, because the only way to have health system functioning again is to have a security where health workers, where patients can safely access hospitals.
And for supplies like soap and shampoo to enter and be distributed in an orderly manner, he says. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Our reporters in the U.S. and throughout the world have been following the repercussions of the Israel-Hamas war in the Middle East and globally. Find more of that in-depth coverage on our website, theworld.org.
Police in Nigeria today arrested scores of people for carrying Russian flags as they marched through streets in northern cities.
The protests in Nigeria began 6 days ago. At least seven people have died and more than 700 have been arrested so far. At issue is the economy, specifically the end of government subsidies for fuel. That's caused prices at the pump to go up and sent food costs spiking.
But about those Russian flags.
Well, the police have arrested people, including manufacturers of Russian flags, alleged to have encouraged street demonstrations.
There were also scenes of protesters flying the Russian flag in neighboring Katsina State. The protesters, mostly young people, started from a family home.
Some youths in parts of Kano State calling on the Russian government to come to their rescue.
Only a few of the thousands of people out protesting were carrying Russian flags, but this was enough to cause Nigerian authorities to issue stern warnings today.
We will not accept anybody, any individual, flying any foreign flag in Nigeria. That is a treasonable offense, and it will be viewed and treated as such.
A treasonable offense, says Nigeria's top military man, General Christopher Musa.
For people, subversive elements to push individuals to carry Russian flags in Nigeria, Nigerian sovereignty, that is crossing the red line. I will not accept that.
In at least two different Nigerian states, local tailors were accused of creating the flags. A video circulating on TikTok shows three men at a big industrial sewing machine. They're stitching together the iconic white, blue, and red striped banners of the Russian Federation. Videos from at least three Nigerian states show the flags being carried by demonstrators.
Although an investigation is underway, it's not clear yet who's behind this whole flag thing, but there's plenty of speculation.
The coups that have happened in the countries around the north,
yes.
For many people, they believe that those coups were sponsored by Russia.
That's part of a discussion on a popular Nigerian TV morning show called Sunrise Daily. It's no surprise that Nigerians would look at Russian influence in neighboring countries. In Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, military dictatorships have overthrown democratically elected governments with support and, in some cases, ground troops from Russia. Nigeria's Western ally government does not want the same fate.
Ahead this hour, more on the West Africa-Russia connection. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Rewind with us for a moment to 24 hours ago and a nail-biter drop in the markets led by Japan's benchmark Nikkei Index. Nose-diving markets can become self-fulfilling prophecies, as Simon Rabinovich at The Economist told us.
The longer the sell-off persists, it will become a headwind itself for the U.S. and for the global economies.
That was yesterday. Today, things aren't quite back to normal, but almost. The Nikkei rebounded more than 10%. U.S. and European markets were up, too. Yesterday's big market dip was spurred in part by the latest U.S. jobs report.
Our next report is not about the financial markets, but it does start in Japan, where they celebrate a midsummer festival that's called Doyo no Ushi no Hi, or Eel Day in English. It goes back to Japan's Edo period, so the 18th century, and then, like now, temperatures got hot in midsummer, just not so intensely and for so long.
Still, no one wanted to cook, so people turned to cold, smoked, marinated eel, the unagi you might recognize from sushi menus.
These days, though, eel is not always easy to come by, and higher prices mean anyone who sticks close to tradition might have to make do with barbecued sardines, for example.
This is where scientists step in. They're working to increase the global supply of eel and bring down the cost, and in the process ensure that global supplies of seafood don't require the sea to survive.
One side of the story comes from Japan.
Chef Kutsumoto is the executive chef at Saito Restaurant, which was named the best vegan restaurant worldwide.
Katsumi Kutsumoto has become something of a celebrity chef in Japan for his awareness of the environmental pressures on food systems and his adapting menus to be less reliant on mass-produced animal protein. This is from a pop-up last year in Los Angeles, sponsored by Japan House, where he led a cooking workshop. It's thinking outside the bento box that got Chef Kutsumoto to partner with a high-tech food company in Israel called 4C.
The Japanese consumed 160,000 metric tons of eels in the year 2000. Today, they consume only 30,000, and that's because it's just not available.
Co-founder and CEO of 4C, Roy Neer, says most varieties of eel are in short supply as endangered and protected species. And eel is expensive because it takes several years to raise them for harvesting. Earlier this year when I was in Israel, I had a chance to check out what 4C is up to. Remember, this is not like the eel meat version of the Impossible Burger, which is a mix of various plant proteins. This is, well, I'll let Roy Neer explain it.
What we do is we grow mini tissues or organoids, and we basically mimic the natural development of cells in nature. Our tissue is a natural composition of fat, muscle, and the extracellular matrix.
The extracellular matrix, animal flesh, but developed in a stainless steel bioreactor.
So you're really trying to emulate what the real eel is all about. It's many different types of cells put together.
Yes, so not only eel. We are not an eel company. We're a cultivated meat company that is focused on fish and seafood. And our first product is the meat of the freshwater eel.
Doing all the analytical method in order to characterize better the cell lines that we are growing.
In its current R&D phase, 4C's operations all take place on one floor in a building in Rehovot, just outside Tel Aviv. The eventual eel meat is being developed right down the hall from Neer's office. Moria Shimoni, another of 4C's co-founders and their chief tech officer, gave me the tour.
This is where the magic happens. Actually, you know, all of the places is where the magic happens. It starts with the cellular isolation. It continues with the media development. This is actually the media that are introduced inside the bioreactor. Is a media that we develop.
When Shimoni says media, she means the complex formula that feeds the eel cells that grow in the bioreactor. In that sense, the magic really does happen in the bioreactors, stainless steel tanks that mimic the temperature, oxygen, and nutritional needs of each cell line that the team at 4C sticks in them as they trial and error their way to something that tastes like unagi. Roy Neer says cultivated meat grown in a lab has many benefits over conventional fish farming, but there is one biggie.
The aquaculture that has been helping in closing the supply-demand gap in recent decades is considered quite impactful for the environment. And what's expected to close the supply-demand gap of fish and seafood is cultivated meat.
Cultivated meat also eliminates the need for growing animal feed crops. So when it comes to climate change emissions, various studies have shown that cultivated beef, anyway, could improve the situation over real cows, although other studies suggest that the infrastructure around cultivated beef could actually increase those emissions. There are other benefits the cultivated eel industry is promoting, like a massive drop in microplastic pollution once you abandon fishing nets. All of these pluses, though, depend on one big obstacle that I heard about from Rowenir and from Faraz Farsini, a senior scientist at the Washington, D.C.-based Good Food Institute, where he focuses on the development of lab-grown meat.
With cultivated meat, the challenge is really to scale it up.
Right now, the cultivated meat industry has proof of concept, but there's a ways to go still before you'll find cultivated eel in a cooler in the produce department. Farsini says that will require better and more cost-effective bioreactors and less expensive media to feed the cells. But if that can happen, Farsini is optimistic about the benefits.
This is something people don't realize. The United Nations says that the top drivers of the next pandemic are due to increased demand for animal protein.
In other words, as the production of conventional chicken, pork, and beef is increasingly industrialized to feed the world's growing population, the probability of another outbreak of some disease, avian flu, swine flu, or COVID, will increase. Cultivated meat lowers that risk.
Because it's a process that is completely under control, you are constantly sampling and testing for any microbes, any contamination, and you know, if you have contamination, you just waste a batch.
Farmers pump their livestock with antibiotics to prevent infections and to make them grow faster. Cultivated meat also eliminates the need for antibiotics. And Faraz Farsini, like many scientists, is deeply concerned about where continued reliance on antibiotics in the current food system will take the planet.
According to WHO's director, former director, it's going to be the end of modern medicine when we have antibiotic-resistant pandemic. Again, that's a problem that is completely mitigated with cultivated meat.
Israel has become something of an incubator for companies on the cutting edge of cultivated meat. Just down the road from 4C is Aleph Farms, which is working on cultivated beef. No fewer than half a dozen cultivated meat operations are scattered around the country. Why Israel? Faraz Farsini of the Good Food Institute, which has an affiliate office there, says the Israeli government has actively supported food innovation because
Israel relies heavily on importing meat, and so for them, again, it's a matter of national security.
As it seems it should be for the rest of the world. For Rowenir at 4C, it's work that he's excited to take on every day.
You know, I myself, I'm a big ocean lover. And, you know, cultured fish and seafood, how many industries, you know, that are targeting two of the world's biggest problem, you know, nutrition and climate?
I did not get a chance to taste cultivated eel. There were no samples at 4C the day I visited. But if you're a little patient, you can. Rowenir expects 4C's first product will reach the market late next year or early 2026.
You're listening to The World. The Portuguese community in New England has been celebrating the Feast of the Blessed Sacrament for more than 100 years. This year's event saw a big change.
Oh, I'm so happy. I talk about it, I get goosebumps. And my granddaughters kept saying, when is our turn?
New faces for an old tradition ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Because its online search tools are everywhere, Google is also a verb. That speaks volumes about the power of Alphabet, its parent company. But a ruling from U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta says that the global tech giant has been illegally exploiting its dominance to crush competition and smother innovation. The decision to label Google a monopoly is a seismic one, but in Europe, people might be less surprised by this kind of ruling. Regulators there have tried for some time to push big tech players to act in line with the European Union's antitrust laws. Zach Myers is with the Center for European Reform, where he works on EU competition policy, especially in the digital sector. I spoke with him earlier, and he gave us his views on this new ruling against Google.
So essentially, this case concerned Google's deals with companies like Apple to be the default search engine. So Google was paying in 2021 about $26 billion a year to other players in the ecosystem to make sure that it was Google that users were using first and without having to really think about it. And so the concern here was that when you've got other players like Microsoft's Bing, they just can't get enough market share to become kind of sustainable and to get the number of users and to see the number of queries that they need to be able to see to become as good as Google. And so the problem was that this became kind of a self-perpetuating cycle.
How much does this legal ruling in the U.S. impact the way things work in Europe?
I mean, it's interesting because, as you said, authorities in Europe have been concerned about Google and the other tech companies for quite a long time now. And there's been at least three cases in Europe that have resulted in big fines against Google for various aspects of their conduct. But I think it's fair to say that there hasn't really been any change in market shares. A lot of the remedies that were proposed in these cases never really succeeded in giving competitors a real chance. And so it'll be interesting to see whether kind of America has a better shot at this.
From your point of view, Zach, do you see the US kind of catching up to the European point of view on this issue?
So in Europe, we've moved away a little bit from these antitrust cases because they take, you know, 10 plus years to go through the appeals process to get any remedies bedded in. And even then, you don't really see changes to market shares or to practices in the market. Or in some cases, like in terms of online shopping, you see a player like Amazon comes along and, you know, becomes the big new player. And so kind of Google's practices in that area are kind of irrelevant by the time that the cases are done and dusted. And so Europe has moved now towards what's called like an ex-ante approach, which means that there are rules that are put in place to govern future behavior rather than looking at what's happened in the past. But it's interesting, I think, that there's conduct that the US authorities were going after in this case isn't something that these new rules in Europe have, you know, they properly cover.
You also said, Zach, that Europe is looking deep into the future. So is the US really far ahead of the curve, or is it Europe?
Well, I think in areas like AI, yes, Europe has regulation, but it's not really focused on antitrust and on making sure that there are competitors in the market. And the FTC and the DOJ in the US are looking at this quite closely, and you know they might bring cases much sooner than Europe does. So I think it's not really clear yet whether the EU or the US are going to be the leaders in this space. Until now, it's been Europe because you know you had administrations for a long time that saw Google, Facebook, Amazon as kind of national champions that should be protected. And Europe obviously didn't feel so constrained. What will be interesting to see is whether the situation changes again.
You know, when AT&T was forced to break its monopoly back in the day, it got broken up into different companies, the so-called baby bells. Can you imagine a similar thing happening to Google / Alphabet?
It's something that the US authorities have kind of raised as a potential in this case. So it's definitely something that the judge is going to have to look at in the second stage of this case when they look at remedies. But you know, there's a range of other choices that you could imagine as well. So one would be to simply prohibit Google from making these special deals with Apple and other companies. Or another might be to have kind of choice screens so that you know, when you open up an Android device, you've got to choose which search engine you want to be the default in the future.
I mean, for two decades now, Google's been synonymous with web browsing and internet searches. It's kind of a pillar of the internet. What would it mean if it were hobbled in some way?
I mean, very difficult to know. So, for example, there'd be definitely effects on other companies. So Apple is getting tens of billions of dollars a year from Google to keep Google being the default on iPhones. And it's hard to know what would happen if Apple doesn't have that money. So one option would be that they decide, well, we'll build our own search engine because, you know, that way we can control more of the user experience. And, you know, that could provide more of a threat to Google than Bing does today, which could be really positive. So I think it's, you know, it's fair to say that the impacts of this case could really ricochet across the whole of the internet.
Zach Myers is the assistant director at the Center for European Reform. He joined us from London.
The West African country of Mali has cut diplomatic ties with Ukraine. This comes after new information surfaced about a battle in Mali last month. Insurgents attacked Malian government forces and the Russian mercenaries fighting alongside them. The Tuareg fighters who led that attack say they killed about 130 troops, including men from Russia's Wagner mercenary group. A Ukrainian military official recently claimed that Kyiv provided intelligence to the Tuareg insurgents for that deadly attack. It all seems to add up to Ukraine and Russia being in a proxy fight in West Africa. Philip Obagi Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Beast based in Nigeria, where he reports on the Wagner Group's operations across the African continent.
What happened, as we understand, is that the Russians and the Malians had been in Tindouaten, which is the community or the region near the border with Algeria, and they somewhat had some gains in the beginning because they had fought against these Tuareg separatists. And when they realized that they didn't have enough manpower and enough ammunition, they called for reinforcement from their colleagues, you know, elsewhere. And while some of these contingents were even pulling away from the region, they faced a new, stronger and energized group of Tuareg separatists and also Al-Qaeda-backed fighters who overpowered them, killed many of them, and then also captured some Russians and Malians alive.
You say it was a new, energized group of Tuareg fighters. What do we know about the role that Ukrainian intelligence played there?
We had the spokesperson of the Ukrainian military intelligence saying that, you know, they assisted these Tuareg fighters to be able to deal with the Russians, but he didn't really specify as to what exactly the Ukrainians did to support, you know, these militants.
Yeah, so, he said, I think they received necessary information, but not just information.
Yeah, exactly. And he hasn't really spelled out what kind of information was given. So it's still not clear as to how much involvement Ukraine had in this whole incident.
So we don't know exactly how Ukraine was involved, but yes, we know that it was. Exactly. It, of course, has its own war to fight. Why is it interested in assisting on this faraway front?
Well, we've seen some level of Ukrainian involvement in Africa of late. We heard that in Sudan, you know, Ukrainian forces were actually helping, you know, the Sudanese army target Wagner personnel, so to speak, because we've heard already that Wagner is assisting the Rapid Support Forces, which is the paramilitary group that is fighting against the Sudanese armed forces in Sudan. So we have seen already Ukrainian involvement in the conflict here in some parts of Africa, in Sudan, for example. So it's no surprise that we're hearing that Ukraine had some involvement in the incident in Tinswaten in Mali. Yeah.
Can you tell us, for those of us who aren't familiar with the Tuareg people, can you tell us a little bit more about them in that part of Mali?
Oh, yes. You know, the Tuareg is dominant in the northern part of Mali. They have spoken a lot about issues around marginalization, lack of proper involvement in administration in the central part of Mali. So they have been seeking to establish their own state, which they call Azawad. And since 2012, they have been carrying out a campaign against the Malian government just to be able to achieve independence. In 2015, they reached an agreement with the Malian government for peace, an agreement that will see them drop their arms and then seek ways at which, you know, they can establish some level of cooperation with the Malian government. But that has not worked out because for some reason, you know, there's been a breach in that understanding. And it's even made worse by the fact that the Malian government kicked out the French and UN forces, which the Tuareg separatists were not happy about. And since then, they have carried out more attacks, and their campaign has grown a lot more violent, so to speak.
So the Tuaregs are you know, waging this battle to try to get their own independent land. They've also, paired up with this local jihadist group. What role is that group playing?
In the beginning, in 2012, there was already an understanding, or let's say a cooperation between the Tuaregs and Al-Qaeda-backed jihadists. This we saw in 2012 when, you know, the conflict began in northern Mali. But much later, that cooperation, you know, hit the rock. They started to be fighting between the Tuaregs and Al-Qaeda militants in one hand, and also the Tuaregs and ISIS-backed militants on the other hand. But this attack in Tinswaten has made the whole thing rather interesting, because the last we heard about the Tuaregs and, you know, Al-Qaeda working together against, you know, the Malian government was in the early stages of the conflict, you know, that began in 2012. So this is something new that we're seeing right now, and it must be because both the Russians and the Malian armed forces have been targeting the jihadists separately from the separatists. So, you know, these two are now feeling that they need to come together to fight the common enemy.
Philip Obagi Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Beast based in Nigeria. And now a few updates on some other news stories we've been following. Hamas says it's chosen Yahya Sinwar as the new head of its political bureau. This follows the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh last week in Tehran. Sinwar is the secretive leader who planned the militant group's October 7th attack. He is believed to be in hiding in the Gaza Strip.
The top prosecutor in Venezuela has announced a criminal investigation against two leading opposition figures. That's because they had called on Venezuela's armed forces to stop supporting President Nicolas Maduro and stop cracking down on protesters. Venezuela's political opposition has offered up credible evidence showing that Maduro did not win the election on July 28th, fair and square. But Maduro is not backing down.
And outside the Paris Games, public health experts are calling on the Olympics to ditch sponsorship by Coca-Cola.
And that relationship goes back to 1928 when Coke still had cocaine in it. The concern now is sugar. Of course, too much sugar is associated with diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and other conditions.
And that's a few things you might have missed.
For more than a century, the old whaling town of New Bedford, Massachusetts, has hosted the Feast of the Blessed Sacrament. The event celebrates Portuguese culture, one of the biggest roots festivals in New England. But this year, behind the scenes, something big is changing. For the first time, and under threat of a lawsuit, women are allowed to join the feast committee. From station WCAI, Jeanette Barnes reports from New Bedford.
An impromptu dance, a little bit like a conga line, has started here at the feast grounds in New Bedford. But it's only a break from today's real task, the hanging of the greens. On the Sunday before the feast, volunteers go out to Westport to cut bayberry. They fill an entire roll-off, and it's been emptied here in the middle of this open-air building. The greens will be lashed to about 70 metal arches to decorate the parade route. Bayberry fragrance is everywhere, and the energy here is contagious, not just because this is a celebration of family and love and heritage, but also because three generations of women are here, and their status has changed.
I think everyone, you can see everyone's here with open arms. I just flew in yesterday, but I've just felt nothing but love, and I think most of the women could agree with that as well.
Jenna Peck-Soto is 29 and lives in Georgia now, but she's one of seven women who agreed to sue the Madeiran Club, which puts on the feast, if the men wouldn't let women join the much-honored feast committee and the club itself. A vote to allow women failed last fall. Then in April, armed with the potential lawsuit, supporters finally got the 75% majority of men's votes they needed.
We're so excited. You know, my sister's on the committee, my cousins, my aunt, my grandmother. It's different. We're seeing the feast through a new light that we're able to actually be a part of the planning.
Her great-grandfather was one of four men from Portugal's Madeira Islands who founded this feast. Yet her grandmother was unable to serve. Until now. She's here, sitting in a chair, trimming the bayberry to make sure it's right.
Maria Luz Coutinho Pachut. I'm 87. It's hard to believe that we finally got in, that we've been waiting this for many years.
Women have volunteered all along, doing preparation and working in the food and souvenir stands. But she says she never thought she would see this change in her own lifetime.
Because the man is stubborn. A lot of the men weren't happy about it, but we're here, and we're here to stay.
During the April vote, Jane Gonsalves was waiting outside. She's a former city councilor in New Bedford and another of the group who hired a lawyer. She says the secret ballot was contentious.
That's what we've heard. I mean, there are people that are really unhappy about it. And that day, as the members left the meeting, there were a lot of members that didn't talk to us on the way out. Didn't congratulate us, didn't look at us, anything.
She says a loss in court or a settlement would have cost the club money and possibly its nonprofit status. So the men ended up with little choice. She's expecting some bumps along the road to inclusion, but she says she still feels good about the vote, just not naively so. Some men have openly supported the change. One of them is John Alves, vice chair of the Museum of Madeiran Heritage, adjacent to the feast grounds.
While on the outside, we look like an old feast, you know, frying linguiça, putting the money in the cigar box. We're not. You know, serious business.
With the full inclusion of women, he says the club is already reaping benefits. Women are bringing new skills in things like law and public relations.
In all kinds of services that an organization like ours needs now. And we know the responsibility of that because we support a lot of charities, a lot of scholarships, and we need to do this right.
Over at the Feast Grounds, each time they finish one of the Bayberry Arches, they lift it high to walk it out to the street. With every arch, the women here get closer to Sunday's parade on the closing day of the feast. They'll be cheered in their first public recognition as members of the committee. Jenna Peksoto says it's going to be very emotional.
But very incredible to just feel the connection to my great-grandfather while I stand next to my grandmother. So, just feeling very loved and very connected to my heritage right now.
And her grandmother, she's ready too.
Oh, I'm so happy. I talk about it, I get goosebumps. And my granddaughter kept saying, when is our turn? We finally got our turn.
Every year, the club takes a group photo of the feast committee. Men in matching suits. They line the museum walls, dating back to the early 1900s. For many here, this year's photo and feast will go down in family lore, as the year keeping a culture alive didn't hold anyone back. For The World, I'm Jeanette Barnes, New Bedford, Massachusetts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We've seen some big names win gold at the Olympics so far. Serbia's Novak Djokovic in tennis, the one and only Simone Biles for Team USA. But some of the newer sports with much lesser known names are getting attention too.
Wow, il l'a fait! Gaudi Vast, champion olympique, il l'a fait!
Cowley Vast won the men's surfing competition last night by powering through the barrel of what was called the best wave of the day, while Arissa True finished first in the women's park skateboarding competition today. And then there is sport climbing, a.k.a. competitive rock climbing. The World's Bianca Hillier is here to fill us in on that relatively new event. Bianca, I understand the climbing competition has changed quite a bit since its Olympic debut last time in Tokyo. What's different this year?
So in Tokyo, each athlete competed in all three kinds of climbing, boulder, lead, and speed. Their scores on all three got added up to determine who won gold. So there was one woman who won gold and one man. But now, speed climbing is getting separated into its own event. So boulder and lead scores will still be combined to have one winner, and there will be a separate winner for speed climbing.
Okay, so I think I can picture bouldering and speed climbing, but refresh my memory on what all three of these are.
Of course. Bouldering is when you have a short amount of time to climb a wall. There's no ropes or harnesses. Then there's lead climbing, where athletes climb as high as they can in 6 minutes. And lastly is speed. It's a race against the clock where athletes climb a wall as fast as possible, just like it sounds.
Okay, so who are you excited to watch in this second ever Olympic climbing competition, Bianca?
Well, in speed climbing, yesterday, Poland's Alexandra Miroslav actually smashed the world record. She got up the wall in just 6 seconds.
Oh my gosh, that sounds fast, but how tall exactly is this wall?
Nearly 50 feet high, if you can believe it.
Whoa, that's blazing.
Yeah, and she's going to compete again in the next round tomorrow. But then there's Team Japan. There's a lot of excitement around these Japanese athletes. I got to speak with their coach, Benjamin Hartman, and he told me, as a German who knows English but doesn't know Japanese, his first step to working with the team was figuring out the language barrier.
In the beginning, we said that I should stick with English because for the athletes, it's a good opportunity to practice English.
Since then, he admits he's been a little bit lazy when it comes to learning Japanese. That's ended up working in his favor, though, as a sort of icebreaker with the athletes.
Especially for the younger athletes when they're a little bit nervous and they see that, okay, even the coach is talking in really bad Japanese, then they are not so afraid to talk bad in English, so...
Whatever they're doing, it's working. Team Japan has steadily risen through the ranks since Hartman joined in 2008. Their success started with Japanese climbing legend, Akio Noguchi.
The left hand lands, Right hand goes across to join it. Kiyo Noguchi, the magician, comes up with something special here.
She won 21 World Cups, which is what the sport's major competitions are called. Then there's Tomoa Narasaki.
The big thing was when Tomoa Narasaki won the bouldering world championship in Paris in 2016.
Awesome work for Tomoa Narasaki. Oh, and easily tops out. That's why this guy is so good.
And from that on, it kind of exploded.
Narasaki has since won 8 World Cups and earned his spot in Paris. His younger and taller brother, Meichi Narasaki, is also a force on the global stage and is currently ranked 2nd in the world.
Gets ready, starts the swing. Yes, she's in.
Japan's women's side has expanded too. Both Akio Noguchi and Miho Nanaka made the podium at the Tokyo Olympics.
What a moment for the nation that has done so well to host these games.
Nanaka is seeking another medal this year in Paris. Coach Benjamin Hartman says this continued success is no accident. He's trained his athletes to have a unique climbing style that centers on flexibility and efficiency.
It's not about going from hole to hole. It's more about going from one body positioning to the next one.
Team Japan is known for contorting their bodies and creating incredible tension to seemingly defy gravity. Other countries, like Team USA, spend time lifting weights in the gym. But Hartman says his crew almost exclusively trains on the wall.
Many other national teams, I see, we need to get stronger and stronger and stronger. But the thing is that you need to be able to transition the strength in a sport-specific way.
In other words, he believes the best way to get better at climbing is by climbing, specifically climbing under pressure.
I really like to play games, and I sometimes play some nasty games in training just to prepare them. Because if you are always nice in training and then they hit the competition and then suddenly they are faced with a super stressful situation and they cannot cope with it, yeah, then the training was not good.
Hartman says in some of these nightmare rounds, he limits a climber's time or attempts, or he purposefully leads them the wrong way and makes them figure out the proper route. Another major focus point since Tokyo has been mental strength.
This man, Stevie, is quite staggering.
Despite being a heavy favorite to win gold in 2021, Tomoa Narasaki slipped in the finals and failed to make the podium.
For the local man, born just 150 kilometers away, finds himself down. Exhaustion taking its toll. The burn of the shoulders, the grip just slipped.
He was crazy nervous, and I think this time he really knows what to expect and he will be way better prepared mentally.
Competitors have taken notice.
I would say Team Japan has really taken climbing to the next level recently.
Team USA climber Jesse Grupper expects Narasaki and the entire Japanese delegation will put on a strong show in Paris.
Just watching their team compete, it's like so clear that their style is very uniform, but also like they have representation on a lot of different styles as well. They're incredibly talented at coordination, at power, at all the things that make a climber really amazing.
Alongside Narasaki in Paris will be teammate Sarato and Raku.
Huge jump. Look at that. The Superman holds it with the right.
The 17-year-old burst onto the World Cup circuit just last year. So far in Paris, he's making a statement.
We have seen our first top on the second problem, and it goes to the youngest athletes in the field.
Sarato and Raku finished in first place after a really tough bouldering semifinal yesterday. He'll compete again tomorrow morning in the lead competition.
So, Bianca, we've got some climbers to watch on Team Japan now. But, of course, I assume they do have some competition. So who's expected to be pushing them on that wall?
Yeah, there's definitely competition. And the real obstacle in the women's competition is reigning Olympic champ Janja Gonbret from Slovenia. She's just head and shoulders above the rest of the field. And I think she doesn't get enough credit as one of the best athletes in the world across all sports. And for the men, I'm going to be curious to see how Toby Roberts does. He's 19 years old from Great Britain. He's been looking really good so far, and it's going to be a tight race for gold.
The World's Bianca Hillier all across our Olympics coverage.
That is our show today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.